Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, here for show number 99, which means we are just about at that magical 500 mark. If you pull together the old show and the new show, I can hardly believe that that's the case, but time goes by quickly. The date is Thursday, December 19th. You can probably hear that in the background, scrabbling down the stairs to join us for the show, Muggsy the Handicapping Labrador. But we have a very special guest. His appearance earlier this year, one of the top downloaded and listened to shows of the entire year, I'm happy to say. And I'm happy to also say that I've been interviewing this gentleman for, gosh, more than a dozen years, and he just keeps coming up with new reasons for me to reach out and talk to him, not the least of which is he is a very compelling figure in the gambling and horse racing world. I'm talking about my old buddy Dave Gutfreund. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. That was quite the introduction. I'm not worthy.
It's absolutely true. I mean, excepting obviously like Derby show and Breeders' Cup show, those numbers are through the roof. But for your shows that aren't about, you know, those type of days, the downloads were crazy. People really wanted to hear your story of your improbable win in the NHC Tour. Not improbable because of anything other than how few events you actually played in. And I did see that you qualified. I'm assuming it was your second qualification for next year's NHC that you won at Los Alamitos last weekend. Let's start there. How did you get it done at Los Alamitos? And what is it that makes you a horse player for the course at Los Al?
Go back to your first point. It was my second seat, though it was the first one I actually earned in 2019, as the first seat was part of the tour package from last year. So that was a good thing. The Los Alamitos tournament just seems to fit a niche for me, apparently. You know, having won the December event 2 years in a row now, it's a live bankroll tournament. I've won both of the tournaments with betting on the last race in different ways for different reasons. And, it just has worked. I'd like to say that I'm a Los Alamitos expert, but that's not the case. I would just say that, you know, that there was some good fortune involved and, you know, the field sizes aren't huge. And I was able to do just enough on each of the days to, you know, get the desired result.
You've always been so great at playing the game within a game in contests, and I've never really even heard you express any preferences about mythical versus live bank or different variations in format. You've always told me, hey, make sure the rules are the same for everybody else, which with one notable exception a couple of years ago, we've successfully managed to do. Tell you the rules, you'll figure out how you want to play it, and you've done very well in all manner of formats. But just let me ask you your opinion. We've seen very clearly in these live bank events how the exact way that you've won Los Al twice, so often the path to victory, preserving enough capital to make that one big push in the last race. Do you see that as a flaw in live bankroll tournaments?
There's always going to be a flaw in any sort of tournament, in any sort of, you know, even golf, there's flaws in golf tournaments, for God's sakes. But, you know, yes, I've won each of the tournaments in the last, you know, I won Monmouth in the last race. I won the two Los Alamitos races in the last race. But at the two Los Alamitos contests, I was second both times going into the last race, and at Monmouth I was like in fourth or fifth, so it wasn't as if I was just preserving capital to get to the last race with, you know, the starting bankroll or slightly more than that. I was actually rolling the bankroll and putting myself in a position to win the tournament in three of the tournaments I basically had short price horses in the last race. So I basically had the favorites in the last race. So, you know, your memory on my quotes is correct about just tell me what the rules are, don't change them, and make sure everybody follows the same rules. goals, and you know, that's pretty much how I feel. I also feel very strongly that for the players, Mythical Bankroll tournaments are better tournaments over decent enough sample sizes. You know, a 10-race contest, yeah, it becomes like a stab fest to have the one right winner on the day. But once you get into, you know, 30, 40, 50 races, you know, you're going to have to be consistent and solid and have some nice price winners over that time to win an NHC type of formatted tournament. And it's still, to me, the NHC format is the best format out there as far as over 3 days. Now, it's a long event, don't get me wrong. You know, I think the one-day bankroll tournaments may make more sense than a one-day, you know, Mythical Bankroll tournament, unless you're going to be using 30 races in one day, which is kind of overkill. But I, you know, there is room, there's room for both of them in the venue, but for reasons that go beyond, you know, Mythical money versus, there's a reason I prefer Mythical money versus live money tournaments, especially the bigger money tournaments. And that is because in a Mythical money tournament, the money that is put up as an entry fee goes all into the prize pool. In most of the live bankroll tournaments, you know, 2/3, 75%, 80%. Los Alamitos tournament was 80% of the buy-in was into the bankroll, 20% into the cash money prize pool with two seats added, which was wonderful. But so many of the live bankroll tournaments, you know, so much of the risk is in live money, and oftentimes in smaller fields of, you know, a Pegasus type of tournament or a Kentucky Derby type of tournament, you know, you're asked to risk $6,000, $10,000, or $12,000, and the most you can win is $80,000 or $100,000. I just don't see that as a good opportunity for players. That's just my personal opinion. I've always thought tournaments, what the concept of tournaments was to take a small stake and build it into a decent sized stake.
I get it. I absolutely get it. I would imagine you, like me, are a fan of the trend of seeding the live bankroll pool in addition to having the players' entry money go to that prize pool. I feel like that's a nice way to, in the case of the last Naira tournament anyway, essentially negate the rake that you're playing as you churn your money through the windows, because you know there's that extra money in there. The Pegasus is doing something similar this year. Do you think that mitigates those concerns to some degree, or do the economics still not work out in a way that gets your blood pumping?
Well, the difference to me is more in the buy-in level than it is in what you're talking about. You know, if you go, if this is, once again, this is personal preference. You know, a tournament like the Naira tournament, that's a $500 buy-in tournament, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
You know, risking $500 to win, you know, whatever the first prize is and seats, you know, you don't feel bad about, you know, 500 or nothing at the end of the day. There's a big difference between 500 and nothing compared to 10,000 or 12,000 and nothing and 6,000 and nothing. And, you know, real money is real money. And it's much easier to treat a $500 bankroll like Mythical money and play it completely properly than, quite frankly, it is playing the Breeders' Cup tournament with a $10,000 buy-in and a $7,500 bankroll and playing that like Mythical money. Because at some point, if you build a bankroll to $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, it's hard not to think of that as real money. It just isn't.
It's a great point.
Unless you're made of money.
And that's a whole different, question.
Yeah, that's a whole different question. And it certainly in the bigger money, you know, real money tournaments, it gives an even bigger advantage to those with the biggest stones, if you will.
Yeah, we have played around, as I'm sure you've seen, of the idea of trying to have a format that uses live bankroll principles, but with fake money, a la a poker tournament. We haven't gotten a ton of traction with it yet, but it's an idea that's an ongoing concern and something that hopefully is going to come to fruition, hopefully in the next year or so. Is that a format that interests you as a player?
A little bit, but I'd need to learn more about it. Like I said before, no matter what the format is, there are going to be angles and there are going to be strategies, and eventually people are going to catch on and the system is going to be gamed and everybody's going to be, trying to do similar things. It's like a lot of things. There is, back from the Derby Wars days, I can say this unequivocally, there's just no perfect format that's going to please everybody. There's always going to be holes in the system, if you will, and the idea is to make it as fair and as formful as possible. And let's face it, like I said, going back to the Derby Wars days, some of the games that we built for different reasons to try and reward different things. And once again, you're just never going to please everybody, and there's always going to be a proper, people like me are going to be looking for the right way to play it. And I think with the Mythical Money bankroll, it's going to be similar to like in the Mythical Money online games when people are just searching for the 19-1 shots or the 15-1 shots at times, that they're going to be just betting max money, max mythical money in the right mathematical situations to take advantage of their equity. I mean, that's what you're trying to do, basically.
When you look at the existing contest formats, which one, if any, do you think demonstrates who the best horse player is?
Now, let's keep in mind that a Mythical Money traditional $2 win and place tournament is a completely different event than a live money betting tournament, because essentially the $2 win and place tournament is just picking horses, and the betting tournament is having the skill and the guts to bet properly and the knowledge to bet properly. So to answer the question that you just asked me, I think the latter, even though it often comes down to the end, is more on an individual basis a test of a horse player. It's not necessarily the best contest, but it's a better test of horse player skills, because you need to have more of a skill set to succeed in live money than you do in fake money, mythical money, the $2 win and place tournament.
I think that's right. What if I asked you the exact same question, but replace the word horse player with handicapper?
Then I think I'm going to answer the question the way that you want me to answer the question. Oh, Pete,
there's no is, want here. I'm know, just throwing it out there. I'm just brainstorming with you.
it's more of a selecting contest, the $2 mythical win and place bet than the live bankroll tournament.
I think especially over time.
And the reason it's more of a selecting contest is because the other big difference between mythical money, everybody's betting the same amount on every race, everything's, cookie cutter. You have way more options, way more choices in live bankroll as far as, betting win, betting doubles, betting exactas, betting trifectas, blah, blah, blah. So that's another thing. So that's another reason why, to answer the second question, that a mythical $2 win and place bet is more of a traditional handicapping contest, and it's definitely more about selecting horses.
My own little addendum to that would just be, if you're talking about the one day you're picking one horse, $2 win place in 12 races, I still feel like I don't know that that is, I can't call that a better test of handicapping than live bankroll, because I think in many ways that just becomes a pure math thing when you're, I mean, maybe I'm being too cynical, but I feel like once
you're not being cynical at all. And okay. Those are, like I say, back in the Derby Wars days, that's what we discussed. And unquestionably, the shorter you make the tournament, the less skillful and the more randomness there's going to be to it. The longer you make the tournament, the more skill there is. And that's why when I answered your question a few minutes ago about mythical $2 win and place tournaments, I specifically stated the NHC and you need to have 30, 40 races in that type of format to make it more legitimate and to make it as decent as it can possibly be. But when you shorten it to 10 or 12 races, it's just a crapshoot.
Yeah, I don't think that's wrong. I mean, I get why that has to be the case for day in, day out feeders and things like that. But in terms of the biggest contests, I agree with you.
Just to use a poker analogy, that's why there's tournaments with 20 or 30 minute levels. And that's why there's tournaments with hour and 2 hour levels. The World Series of Poker main event has 2 hour levels. The tournament going on at Bellagio right now with 10,000 entries, $10,000 buy-in and 1,000 entries and $10 million in the prize pool. They have 90 minute levels on day two and day three. The tournament that I was playing yesterday had 30 minute levels. So, for the buy-in, for the quality of the tournament, you're going to get different structures, and that's certainly how it should play out and does in real life play out on the horse racing tournament scene.
Let's pull back a little bit and talk about where racing is in your gambling life portfolio at the moment. How important is horse playing to you as we come to the end of 2019?
How important is horse playing? Not very important, but let me follow up on that question, because I use the word horse playing to refer to day in, day out, betting on the races. Horse racing is still a part of my portfolio, whether I want it, like it or not, because I am still involved with tournaments. The fact of the matter is that the NHC is still a tremendous annual opportunity for me. I will generally participate in the Horse Player World Series. And even in 2019, I didn't play a ton of live events, but, I played a fair few. And from a tournament perspective, I'm not good enough at poker where I can completely walk away from something that I think I can do decent at, is the best answer I can give you. So, I just pay attention to what's going on, but my day in, day out gambling on it is, on Saturdays, maybe, and looking at daily carryovers, see if there's a pick five carryover. But I'm not a regular horse player anymore, and I haven't been for a while.
When you do get involved in those carryover bets, how does your strategy differ when you know there's that extra money in the pool and going to be that extra attention, as opposed to back in the day when you were just playing a normal pick? How does the added money change your approach to bet construction and possibly to your staking?
It has more effect on staking than it does on bet construction. Trying to win, and I'm trying to get the most value for my money. So that goes into the equation of bet construction. But, depending on, and I'll talk about something that I mentioned on Steve's show recently, that was, I screwed up the pick six, the Empire six, a couple Saturdays ago, because on my main ticket, I spent a meager $118. And in a demoiselle, I went four horses deep, and I didn't use Lake, Street or whatever. I forget the horse's name, but the Monica Dolphin, number 12 horse, that was 4-1 in the morning line. That was a daughter of Caput that ran an 83 buyer and was.
Remember everything but the darn, name.
Yeah, and it beat a four. And the reason I didn't play it was I didn't like the draw. I didn't think she'd clear off so easily, and I wasn't impressed because she only beat a four horse field, and I tossed her. And that was an example of where I got the staking wrong, and I very easily. It's so easy to say after the fact, of course, but in that race where I really didn't have a strong opinion, that was a horse I shouldn't have left out, and I got the staking part of it wrong.
Lake Avenue was the name of that runner, and by getting the staking wrong, I assume you mean you just needed to spend a little bit more money given the available opportunity.
Pick six rollovers on the mandatory days from these jackpots, you can get some really good payouts. Gonna kill me to say what I'm about to say. I missed one this summer at Laurel, and it paid me a lot more than the parlay did. I don't know if it was 5, 6, 7, 10 times, but it was incredible at sometimes the value that you can get on these mandatory payouts. And they have so deservedly, so rightly, they just get thrown under the bus, and it just blows my mind that so many people play them on a regular basis. People that I know, people that I like, people that I think are generally smart, and they just don't care, or they think there's ways to make money on it, but they can't make money on it, betting the jackpot wager on a daily basis. And but because of them, you know, plenty of times now with, you know, Naira doing it, all the Stonic tracks doing it, even Churchill doing it, you know, you get somebody could figure it out, but, you know, 10, 12, 14 times a year, you get these mandatory payouts where you get some really good gambling opportunities that you can legitimately tell yourself that are value, and you can be happy about playing.
This question may lead to a greatest hits type answer from you, but that's kind of what I'm looking for anyway. When you're thinking about playing horses today, how would you describe your betting goals?
This is an easy answer. I'm just looking for home runs at this point. I just don't have the time or the patience. You know, when I rarely make win bets anymore. I rarely bet exactas that are paying less than $50. Pick five, I've become a pick five fan. I miss the real pick sixes. If the Stronach five was operated by a different ownership group, I would play it regularly on Fridays.
It's
12% takeout. I can't say that that's bad. There's one significant change that I'm not going to give away that many of your listeners have already figured out for themselves what they could do with the sequence on a regular basis that could be and should be changed. But I'll let them figure it out for themselves. but I'm playing pick fives, you know, mandatory payouts in the 20-cent pick six wagers, you know, occasionally pick fours and pick threes, but I'm going for home runs, and that's pretty much where I'm at.
And it sounds like you've taken the idea of being EV obsessed to another level with your racing play. If you're not convinced,
it's almost like the Houston. It's like the Houston Rockets style. You know, I'm going for. I'm just going to go for the more of the higher variance, but in the long run, better opportunities for me. And then in a different thought process than a Mike Maloney, but when I'm right, I'm going to be right.
Do you consider yourself a better handicapper or a better bettor / manager of your money?
It's not even close. Are you kidding me, Pete? Come on. You're going to make me say this out loud publicly?
We need to get these messages home to people.
I'm a much better handicapper than I am a money manager better. Thankfully, I've realized that over the years, and I've worked hard on the latter skills. And but even to this day, my betting skills still leave a lot to be desired. So if I'm answering that question as honestly as I can.
Which skill do you think is more important to overall success for somebody who, unlike you, is playing all the time?
You have to have both. Yeah, I mean, I've seen arguments on social media recently that you don't need to be able to handicap. That's gibberish. You need to have a clue. Even if you're throwing out, you're tossing favorites, you need to know which favorites to toss, who the good favorites are, who the bad favorites are, who the beatable chalks are, blah, blah, blah. But I think for long-term success, it's probably the latter being a good money manager first, a good better second, and a good handicapper third.
That's great. I've never actually heard it put that succinctly and to my mind, correctly. You've talked about trying to improve as a better. I think that 85% of the people listening, maybe that's a low number, would probably agree that they could be better when it comes to constructing wagers, etc. What would you recommend to somebody looking to get better?
Well, one of the biggest, I don't want to say follies or mistakes that people make, is so much focus is on selections and is done on handicapping. And that's what's out there in the handicapping sphere. And there's really very little discussed to this day, actually, on the art of betting. And I would try and find somebody. Gosh, I should be looking in the mirror, like having a Stuart Smalley moment. Should I get ITP? Call him up and meet him in the mornings for ribs and have a private session with him.
He'll set you straight. He'll set you straight.
Talk to people that you respect. Try and find, if there's research out there, try and find it. It's easier if you communicate, and it's easier if you put in the time and the effort to, search people out or, research or read put in the time. But I would say to somebody, don't just focus on the handicapping, focus on betting strategy and why you're doing what you're doing and have a plan for that.
I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. You talk about the literature that's out there. I think there's plenty of good stuff in the Steve and Chris book. I still think that the Barry Meadow book, the original Money Secrets at the Racetrack, I'll be completely self-serving because it's not really self-serving. It's all Mike Maloney's stuff that I just happened to write down. But his stuff on betting in that book, that's really good as well. But I think the point you made it in a joking way about talking to friends who have this skill. I think that's one of the most important things of all is the networking aspect and just finding people who are doing this that you can learn from. And I don't think there's really any better way than keeping company of people who have this in their skill set. And one of these days we'll get a forum. And we talked about this a year ago when you were on the show, what poker has, the type of hand analysis you can see online that just doesn't, and Jason Beam wrote about it very eloquently in an article, but it we don't really have a place to do that online. And the culture of horse racing and horse betting online and a place like Twitter, unfortunately, doesn't really lend itself to that type of thoughtful analysis. But someday there should be a 2+2 forum equivalent. Maybe it exists somewhere for racing where people can talk intelligently about this stuff. But I think those are all good suggestions. And, you know, as for your own daily affirmations, to loop back to your Stuart Smalley comment, Dave, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and doggone it, people like you.
I'm not sure about the last part, but it's okay.
A lot of people do. I want to talk about your strengths and weaknesses as a horse player slash gambler. Let's start with the strengths part. What about this stuff do you feel like you do well?
I've always been... I was blessed with being pretty numerically, having a mind that worked numerically pretty well, forgetting about names, but having a reasonable memory when it comes to, certain things, and being able to, put puzzles together and, the thing that I do best in horse racing, it just is at this point, is I do very well. My best category is maiden races on the turf. And the reason for that is there's so much art in those types of races compared to a 20 claimer where the same 8 horses on the same circuit have been running for 2 years against each other. The more variables that are involved, I think I'm somehow able to find the right variable in certain spaces, if that makes any sense.
It does. It makes me think about that idea of it was much maligned at the time, but I actually thought there was some interesting stuff in it. The idea of that there are known unknowns and unknown unknowns, and there are certain types of races where you sort of know the market, which is usually so smart in horse racing, is making more leaps in terms of how it comes together. And I think maiden races on the turf are a great example of that, where creativity is going to be rewarded more than a strict ability to process the same information everybody else is looking at. Am I on the right track there?
That's you're in the pew. You're in the right pew. Don't know if you're in the right church. I think it might even be the right pew.
What about weaknesses as a player? You talked about that you're still working on betting as a work in progress, but would that be something you'd list as a weakness still at this point, or is there something else that comes to mind?
Well, I would say looking back over the last however many years, that the time I spent in England was a real eye-opener, and I did significantly learn to be a better bettor during the time I lived in England. And this was in, my mid-40s till basically I was 50, mid to late 40s, if you will. And, you're never too old to learn in this game or pretty much any game out there at all. And don't be afraid to. It's something I certainly wish I would do better. When I was playing on a more regular basis, like a lot of horse players, I wasn't patient enough, and I would be too impulsive, if you will, and I would probably play too many races. And at times, something I deal with in poker to this day, I'm human. I do have emotions, and it's hard. If you deal with a significant bad beat that, as a horse bettor, you can't do anything about when there's horses and jockeys and thousands or hundreds of miles away from you, and you lose a nose finish for thousands upon thousands of dollars after your horse got left at the gate or was 100 wide on the turn or got blocked in the stretch. All those, you know, typical horse pit player groans. And, you know, it's hard at times to not let bad beats affect you, especially when you're going bad. And certainly the emotional side of it for me is something I'm still working on. I can still get better at. And that, and so, yeah, that.
Has that improved the emotional side? I know there were not to bring up sore points, but some semi-famous stories from NHC history of you steaming at the end of tournaments. Is it something that's, I haven't seen examples of it in the last few years in a tournament setting, but do you still struggle with emotion when you're in the heat of battle?
I care. I want to win. I get worked up, you know, I put everything I have into it. I lay it on the line. And before I got involved in poker, in the World Series of Poker, there was literally nothing on the face of the earth I wanted to do more than win the NHC. You know, now there's literally nothing I want to do on the face of the earth, pretty much more, you know, and I say that other than, you know, real like life stuff,
sure,
like family stuff, blah blah blah. And but you know, I
you weakened the point a little bit by throwing the blah 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 in there. I'll just point that out.
Okay. Last year it came out differently. I mean, sadly, I got so drunk after the NHC last year. It's embarrassing to talk out loud about. But I will say, there was a time back in the bad old Maven days when I had entitlement issues, and I thought not just that the NHC was a great annual opportunity, that it was my right to win it. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was awful. It was terrible. Sometimes I was disappointed in myself. Sometimes there were outside circumstances that may have been involved, and, you know, I'm a human being. I've never claimed to be anything, but I've never claimed to be perfect. And I am what I am. And I will say this. On that subject matter, on the topic of getting worked up, you know, the NHC does annually give me an opportunity to change my life financially, but also annually, especially these last, you know, post-Derby Wars years, I mean, there's a huge anxiety factor with all the people that basically effed me in the online contest business regarding Derby Wars in the room, in that place, in that space. And there's a lot of stuff that at this point in my life that comes together in that room while the NHC is going on, that's Mishiga, that I'd like to be able to put out of my head as best I can. And I try to, and it's a huge, huge burden that I deal with, and it's my issue. It's nobody else's issue. It's nobody else's problem. But I'm going to deal with it the best I can this year. If I didn't win the tour, I don't have to talk to anybody. I'll just sit in the corner, put my headphones on, and grind away.
Compartmentalizing is not easy, but I would imagine you have a lot more experience at it than most. When you look back at the last year's NHC, do you feel it was just a case of it wasn't your day, unlucky, or do you feel like some of these external factors might have messed with your mindset in a way that it did hurt your performance materially? I was guessing it was just a random thing that didn't go your way, for the record.
There's going with a zero on the first day, and going and looking back to what happened 16 or 18 years ago, whenever it was, when Mark Beach from Sports Illustrated tagged along with me after Mandy and Keith decided I was the person that should be, you know, assigned to Sports Illustrated writer because I might be the one or whatever. And I just so wasn't ready for Sports Illustrated. I crapped my pants and choked, and it was almost intentional self-sabotage. And there's no question that, you know, there was some level of, you know, the high level of anxiety and the pressure and the expectations and the hopes that I put on myself. It's not an excuse. But it, looking back 10 months, it certainly had to be a factor. I mean, also, to be fair, looking back on that day, it wasn't my day either. So I think both, I mean, it was a combination of the two. And once that individual day got rolling, you know, it just got worse and worse and worse. And the next day was a completely different day, and I felt like a completely different human being the next day because the weight of those expectations was basically gone because I was in Vince McMahon, no chance mode.
I wasn't expecting you to bust out the no chance in hell reference. I appreciate that, though. We're talking about your story. For a lot of people, they might not really remember the Maven days you referred to that well. Now, and it's a good tie-in with professional wrestling, I think, because I always felt like the Maven, I'm just going to call him the Maven character that you played, and just like in wrestling, the best gimmicks are really just extensions of what somebody really is, maybe in an exaggerated way.
Isn't the Iron Sheik a Jew?
There are exceptions to every rule, but typically when you're talking about a wrestling character, it's an extension of who somebody really is. And, you know, maybe that, and you've seen that guy on Twitter. He clearly is that arrogant and crazy.
I love that guy on Twitter.
But this is a character who at times I feel like you completely disavowed. When I first interviewed you, I remember you even saying, this was for Six Secrets of Successful Bettors, and you even saying, don't mention, listen, I'm going to bring this back to a place that you're comfortable with. But you said at that time, you didn't want the word Maven in the chapter, right? Like you were like, I am so over that part of my life. And it does seem like, you know, flash forward 15 years or whatever it is, and it does feel like a persona for fun you dip into from time to time on social media or wherever. But, you know, looking back, how much of you is the Maven? How much of the Maven is still you in 2020?
Well, I mean, I had back in the day, I had a dream. I wanted to be the Dick Vitale of horse racing. I mean, that's why I went to Philadelphia to work on the Racing Network. That's why I would drive up from Philadelphia or fly in from Chicago to do the OTB shows in New York on Mondays and Tuesdays. I could say this at this point in my life with no jealousy, no anything along those lines. I wanted what Jonathan Kinchin has got. I wanted that exactly the opportunity. I wanted to be side by side with, that was back in the days on Randy Moss and, Chris Lincoln, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I was trying to do with the quote-unquote Maven character. And yes, it was boisterous and it was outspoken and cocky and arrogant. And I talked in the third person occasionally. And, you know, looking back on those days, I started it out as a caricature and then I started believing some of the nonsense myself. And, it came out really bad, and I fully get and understand and can even respect how it rubbed a number of people the wrong way. And, you know, I don't regret it for a second. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, the Mandy Mingers and the Keith Chamblins of the world, Ken Kirkner, that's what they wanted me to be. That's what I was encouraged to be. And I'm sure that's what Jonathan's encouraged to be on the Fox shows, for him to wear those crazy shirts and have his hair crazy hair. And, you know, that's what they want.
Be a personality. You can't
be a personality.
Yeah, you
absolutely
can't sell racing without a personality. Yeah.
So, I mean, so that's, you know, that's where I was at with that back in the day. You know, there are, I mean, I did have, you know, a 900 number way back when. I mean, that's where this all silliness started. You know, I did have a radio show, which I think was a precursor in a lot of ways to what Steve Bick has done. I tried to, like I said, take that Maven personality to television, and to the point that one time the NHC was on TV, I was asked to be I was part of the broadcast with Dick Girardi and Randy Moss, I believe was the team.
It's a good team. Do you feel completely that then you went, I guess it makes sense when you got away from that, you gave up on that part. We're much more focused on trying to make money betting horses, I think, and winning the NHC when we talk back in the day. And that's when you were like sort of disavowed it. Where are you with it now? I mean, it's obviously not part of your handle, but you seem much more comfortable with the fact that that was part of your life than you did 15 years ago.
Well, what ended up happening was so much time and effort was spent on being the Maven or working on TV and, you know, being a character, if you will, is I lost a lot of my gambling mojo. And after, the best job I ever had, shout out to Army and everybody in England, my time at Racing World with the Racing UK guys, you know, I went back to, you know, just getting in the trenches and having no other income, and got back to, you know, doing what I did before I had, you know, before I gave myself the Maven name. And I got to being more of a, you know, less of a character and more of a grinder. And more of a value whore, and that's pretty much where I remain to this day. And as far as I'm comfortable talking about it, you know, looking back on it, because, you know, I truly think, and I hope, you know, the people that think I'm a pompous jerk already are going to think that anyways. But I really do think in some way over the course of the two decades of the NHC that I have done quite a bit in various outlets and forms, originally under the auspices of the Maven character, to, you know, really grow contests and to promote contests and to, you know, be, despite all my recent negativity over the last couple of years on social media, in the world of handicapping contests, I've been so overwhelmingly long-term a positive force. I've literally, you know, I'm in your books, I'm in Frank's books. I literally, if it was a movie, you would say I produced and directed Noel's book.
My book wouldn't be half as good if it wasn't for your contributions, not just in the text, but also putting me onto really interesting people to talk to, some of whom have become friends. So you're not just talking out of your hat here. That's legit.
Thank you for saying that. And I really, you know, I think So I don't know how I ended up to this point, this tangent, but, you know, in so many ways, people don't, you know, people not looking me from the long-term circle of where I was, where I essentially was the poster boy for the NHC for the first, you know, few years. You know, Sotman had me come down to Tucson as the only player to talk about, you know, why contests are good to pitch it when they were pitching it to the industry back Amazing. In the day in the late 90s. You know, I think there's a huge misconception about me as far as who I am and what my legacy, if you will, is in the world of horse racing and horse racing tournaments. And, you know, some of it, let's face it, I've done to myself. I mean, you know, you brought up some of the bad behavior issues from, you know, years ago and whatnot. And certainly I've been known to, over the last, you know, couple of years, especially in the post-lawsuit era, to lash out on Twitter. And that certainly doesn't make me seem like a likable character and a positive person at times. But I would say that over the history of horse racing tournaments, that, you know, I think I've been an influential combatant, somebody that's performed at a reasonably good level and stood the test of time. And I've done way more good than I've done bad, and I've made the game significant. I like to think I've made the game better.
I would agree with that. Couple more questions for you. I'm not going to keep you all day, I promise, but I got a couple more important ones to get to. This is maybe just a quick one. You mentioned the 900 number. I wasn't as involved in the game then. I know now the tout business is something that, I don't know, kind of makes my teeth itch. We've been approached on this show. I've been approached individually about, you know, different quote-unquote opportunities in that realm. We feel very strongly about having all our stuff be free on the show. Do you have any regrets about your time as a tout?
Yes and no. The no part of it is I never once did anything in that genre that I feel ashamed at or that I did. I did it as honestly and as straightforwardly as you could possibly do it. It was not anything, there were no boiler room tactics or, you know, all these ridiculous false claims. It was as straightforward and it was honest as possible. And that's one of the reasons why it really never succeeded that well, because, you know, people are expecting miracles and I'm only human and you can't deliver miracles and you just can't. And the regret that I have is I didn't realize, you know, how much of a stain it could be perceived as. And it's easy to look back 20 years and it was a classic example of somebody who got a little bit of notoriety, trying to cash in on that notoriety. And the thing I do regret is, you know, yes, it's a bit of a stain on me. I wish I hadn't, you know, another wrestling chant. You sold out. Yes, I did. I absolutely did. We wouldn't be having this conversation, Pete, unless I did the 900 number. The one other positive thing that I did, having those ads on the bottom of the racing form, was it turned out to be a really good marketing tool. And people, you know, I crammed the Maven name down people's throats in the racing form every weekend for a while. And, you know, people knew who I was.
I want to talk about your time in England. You talked before about how back in the day you wanted the opportunities JK is having in the game now. Well, during your time in England, I wanted to be you. Being on.
You are.
And well, with your help, I've gotten a little bit of the way there.
And on a completely personal tangent that nobody else on this listening is going to care about, Dermot had a wonderful time in Las Vegas, and so did Mr. Quigley.
Oh, fantastic. Good guys both, doing terrific work over there, Sky Sports Racing and AtTheRaces.com, respectively. Had a chance to meet Mr. Quigley in at Santa Anita too, which was a great thrill for me. He's been doing excellent work on there for a very, very long time. And Dermot, I still get to work with on my periodic visits. But you talked about your time in England and you talked about it sort of regrounding you. And I was just curious to get your general thought about fixed odds wagering. I mean, for me, when I'm over there betting on our races, I just do so much better. Looking at my ROI, betting U.S. stuff, especially anti-post, but really just in general versus dealing with the tote, I just feel like it's a superior system. I think it could work here in the year 2019. What are your thoughts about finding increased ways of getting, not necessarily booking, but fixed odds wagering on U.S. races for Americans instead of letting the English have all the fun?
Better well have a damn good price maker.
Well, exchanges, though. I mean, that's the other piece of it.
That's different than having betting with bookmakers. The exchange. I love playing on Betfair when I lived over there. It's awesome. It's terrific. The problem for this country is going to be figuring out a way, it's been the age-old problem, figuring out a way to keep the rate low enough on the exchange to make the exchange, a viable platform, and for it to create enough revenue for racing for purses. If the handle is going to shift from, if the handle would shift to where it is in England, where so little of the money goes through the tote, for example, I think it can work, but it's a huge. Well, the biggest problem you're gonna have a number of problems to overcome. One of them is the idea of people laying horses, betting against horses to win. That's you're gonna have to pass that sort of legislation in all the states.
Isn't every exotic wager a form of betting on a horse to lose, especially the trifecta? I just find these concerns to some degree just paranoid. The idea that if you let you and me the opportunity to fix a race, and the choices were, well, we can do this on an exchange where we're going to leave these footprints, or we can bet it through the tote in a bet like the trifecta, where we're going to have to be, we're going to have to construct a more complicated wager. But the opportunities to make money are kind of limitless, and we won't leave any footprints. I just, like, this could be happening now, and nobody's concerned about it. And here's this thing that could potentially help the industry. I don't know. It makes the integrity arguments make me kind of insane, as you can tell.
There's an old saying, people in marketing, that is real, or perception is reality. And that's a very difficult perception for people to get over. And oftentimes the people legislating on these sort of decisions, very difficult to get past the perception part of, people are betting against horses to win. That means they're going to, do what it takes to have the horses lose. There's incentive for horses to lose.
We'll see what happens. As a player, though, I couldn't agree more. It's a better model. And what's better about the exchange than the booking is, as we've seen over there with bookmakers, all you got to do is start to win, and then the bookmaker doesn't want your money. And that's a totally separate problem that I've talked with a lot of people in U.S. racing, including Tony Joe. But anyway, that was just a little tangent I wanted to get your 2 cents on. I will let you get out of here soon, I swear. But first, I want to hear about your most memorable day at the track, Dave. What do you got for me?
Oh, boy. This is definitely my best story from a racetrack score. And I'm going to try and, because I know we're getting up against the clock, and I want to try and make this quick. 1985. I had moved out to Pasadena. I had moved out to Southern California. And on Big Cap Day, I happened to watch a horse that was a South American horse make its first dirt start in a 2-turn allowance race and win. And it was a good performance. It, you know, kind of was caught the eye. And I had like a mental note that, you know, next time this horse runs on dirt, you know, I'm going to keep my eye on it. Horse came back and ran on the dirt and didn't do anything. I mean, excuse me, came back and went back on the turf, did nothing. And then eventually it showed up in the Met Mile at Belmont Park in 1985. Now, also going on in, that day was a little race going on at Garden State. But Angel Cordero decided to ride Track Baron in the Met Mile and was a huge overbet favorite at like 2-5. But one of my problems living in California with this California horse that I liked in the Met Mile was 1985, there was no simulcasting yet in Southern California. So how am I going to get down on this race? Well, there was simulcasting. One of the early places, Joe Joyce had simulcasting at Arlington. And my best friend Howard lived in Chicago. And Howard, I summoned Howard on the telephone and had him, you know, told him, you know, put up like $300. You know, we're going to bet this horse whose name is Forzando. We're going to play some crazy exactas with some long shots. And, you know, probably going to throw away $300. I'm coming home in a couple weeks. I'll give you the money when I get back. So sure enough, Forzando wins at ridiculously big odds. Horse called Mo Exception, a Florida horse, runs second. The exacta pays massive. And now all of a sudden, Howard's got like these tickets that are worth, you know, $30,000+. He's pooping in his pants. He's never been so scared in his life. But, you know, back in the day before simulcasting, so it was just crazy having a note on a horse that ran it on Big Cap Day at Santa Anita. When, and that was back in the day when racing at Santa Anita was incredible and the crowds were through the roof. And, you know, having a trip note on a horse and, you know, you're not supposed to be able to get down. And, you know, I was able to get down on the horse. And at that time, that was the biggest score I ever made on a horse race. And I'd been living in California up to that time for like 6 or 7 months. And the struggle was real before then. I mean, and that was like literally just Steel Billy D's favorite racetrack calling line. That was me going from the outhouse to the penthouse.
Were you betting horses for a living at that point, or were you doing other work?
Absolutely. I was full-time. I had left the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago in November of 84, and I was living in Southern California, and I was a regular at the Southern California racetracks, and I paid for my education those first 6 months.
Oh, yeah. Now, how did you know the horse was in? Was it just because it was a big race like the Met Mile and you read it in the racing form?
Oh, yeah. I mean, stories were like in the week. I was like in panic mode. What am I going to do? How am I going to bet this horse? Right? You know, Woody, and we got there.
That's amazing. Back in the day, how did you keep track of where a horse would appear? I mean, were you scouring every day? It's not like there was stable mail in 1985.
Oh my God. I used to have the biggest stack of racing forms. you couldn't imagine. There, you know, the friend of mine that I mentioned, Howard, can't bring it up fast enough from the days we lived together. But I mean, I'd have stacks of racing forms almost as tall as me. You know, I keep them for a couple of years. And that, you know, that was back in the day. That was the only way you could have old charts was save your racing form. There was no Equibase.
Right.
There was no chart. There was no charts on you. I mean, even if you wanted to pay for them online, even if you wanted to pay for the data, you couldn't.
If that horse had appeared in Northern California, you might have missed it. Or did you have any systematic way of keeping track of your bet backs? It was a stakes level horse, so it's a different question.
I probably would have seen it in stakes horses are definitely a different question.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of how you have a trip horse on a minor level back then. I mean, I imagine you missed it half the time.
Well, if there's horses moving, you know, horses changing circuits, yes. But now, even back then, arguably even more so back then, 35 years ago, Southern California, I don't want to say it was a closed shop, but, you know, there was very little shipping going in or coming out.
Right.
It was the same horses, same trainers, same jockeys. And what a jockey colony back then. Oh, my.
It was crazy. And I've heard stories of guys who would cut out Mark McGwire, specifically the contest player, not the home run hitter, had a story about how the ones he was really interested as bet backs, he would cut out the PP and tape them to his refrigerator. That was his stable mail circa 1985.
We all had our little ways doing it.
Fantastic stuff. All right. Well, I've kept you long enough. I think we got to a lot of good ground and some new ground, which is always nice for somebody I've interviewed half a dozen times. It's always great catching up with you. Very excited that you're going to be back at the NHC Double Barreled. No doubt we'll be talking. I'll be out there broadcasting with Steve Bick for the 3 days. That'll be fun. We'll be doing a little preview show. Maybe we'll pull you back in for that as well. Dave Gutfreund, thank you so much for your time today.
Have a terrific holiday season. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year to everybody, and may the horse be with us.
Oh, fantastic. That'll do it for this edition of the show. Going to thank Dave Gutfreund one more time. We'll thank our sponsors, including Black Type Thoroughbreds, 10 Strike Racing, and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making this show, this year of shows, so much fun to do. This has been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. Hey, everybody. Just wanted to give a word for our latest partner, Stats Race Lens. This is a product that is definitely worth checking out. You can even get discounts if you use the promo code STATSITM. We're talking about customizable PPs with comprehensive research abilities, video replays, advanced search and notifications, access to Stats True Odds, handicapping angles, and back testing. That's what Scott Coles used to help him win the NHC this year, and he's talked about on this show. It's mobile and tablet friendly. Stats Race Lens, bringing clarity to handicapping. And make sure you use the promo code STATSITM. STATSITM.